Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to My Perfect Console. I'm Simon Parkin, and in each episode I invite a guest to pick the five video games they would like to immortalise on their very own fictional games machine. Perhaps it was the first game they received as a birthday present, or the one that so obsessed them it caused them to fail their exams, or maybe it was the only thing that got them through a difficult breakup. Games, a bit like songs, often become powerfully attached to a particular moment in our lives. When we return to them, they can become warp points to the past. So join me, Simon Parkin, for My Perfect Console. My guest today is a Dutch video game designer and entrepreneur. While a student at the University of Hawaii, he'd while away the hours playing Dungeons and Dragons with his friends. After he moved to Japan, he then bought a computer and used it to develop a role-playing game of his own called Black Onyx, tailored to the Japanese market. When the game's backer pulled out of the deal, he decided to self-publish and borrowed $50,000 from a friend to set up Bulletproof Software. Black Onyx sold 150,000 copies and influenced the creation of the Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy series. But it was a Russian game that made my guest truly famous, when he helped broker the deal between the Soviet Union and Nintendo that brought Tetris to the world. That story has now been made into a film set to debut on Apple TV later this month. Welcome, Henk Rogers.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So the Tetris story is world famous. Obviously, there's been lots of books and documentaries about how the game became known around the world. But I think this is maybe the first time there's been an adaptation for the cinema or for film. How does it feel to see yourself represented on screen in this way?
It's kind of a surreal experience. You know, there's a lot of things about the actor that are really awesome. That certainly wasn't me, but the fact that I just got on a plane and searched around Moscow, that was an adventure. And I think the movie really captures it very well.
So it sounds like you've seen it.
I've seen it now four times.
Four times, yeah. Were you involved in were you a sort of consultant, or did they just rely on the books and things?
No, actually, both Alexei and I went over the script many times.
Oh, you did? Huh.
And yeah, absolutely. We corrected the things that were correctable. In other words, when they were trying to recreate some scene, we could give them all the details of the scenes so that, certainly the scenes that happen in Russia are there as good as they could be. I should say Soviet Union, because there's a big difference between today and back then.
Yeah, so you were over there just before Gorbachev, weren't you? Well, it was still the Soviet Union and still pretty closed, I suppose, to the world.
Yeah, it was pretty strange. Nobody was supposed to talk to me. You know, I was there on a tourist visa, and tourists aren't supposed to. If you went to North Korea today, you wouldn't be allowed to talk to any people. You know, it's only like government officials that would drag you around and show you only stuff that they want you to see. It wasn't like going to Europe or some other country, civilized, so to speak.
Mm. Yeah. I don't want to get too into like all of the complexities of the licensing deal you were trying to organize, but the story is that you turned up in Moscow really to go and try and get the rights so that Nintendo could publish the Game Boy version of the game, I believe. And
that's correct.
What was it? I mean, how did you feel when you got off that plane? You hadn't had an invitation and you didn't have an appointment. You just decided to get on a plane.
Well, it was, frankly speaking, a little scary. Everything wasn't the way I had ever experienced anything before. And I guess that's the nature of being in a communist country. It just seemed like everyone was unfriendly. You know, usually when I arrive at a hotel, I try to be a little charming and get a smile out of the receptionist. This was not like that. This is like checking into a police station. Nothing fun, all business. Here's your key. That's it. It's like, wow. And the whole airport scene, oh my goodness. There was just not enough light. There were strange smells. There was a puddle of water and a stream of water going through the baggage claim from the men's room, which had overflowed completely. It was strange that this country could be so feared around the world as being a world power.
What did you say to the person on the desk at immigration? You know, you were there on a tourist visa. They said, "What are you here for, sir?"
They didn't ask me that because it was clearly a tourist visa. So they didn't ask me anything about that. So, but I passed her my visa and my passport, and she looked at my visa, which is a separate document. She looked at my visa and she says to me, "You are Danish?" And I said, "No, I'm Dutch." It says you're Danish. And I said, "But I'm Dutch. It must." And she showed me the visa. I said, "I'm sorry, I can't read Cyrillic." You know. And she said, your embassy in Tokyo must have made a mistake. I am Dutch. This is my passport." And at that moment, I was actually thinking, is she actually going to let me in or not? Because my visa doesn't match my passport. I mean, that should be a kind of a red flag if it doesn't match. And I was standing there, but she let me through. So I was surprised. You know, I also thought, are they going to take me in the back room and give me a third degree about trying to fake a visa, you know, or something like that? I had no idea.
Yeah, right. Well, we will return to that scene and to that story in a little bit. I mean, I'm interested. You know, you must talk about this a lot throughout your life. Has the story grown old for you at all?
No, the story's never going to grow old. It's like a fantastic. You know, in the old days, we had adventure games, the text adventure game. This was an adventure game for me, the whole thing. You know, I would be in a situation and try to figure out what the hell's going on. And then have to make a decision. Which way do I go? What do I say? You know, what's the effect going to be if I do the wrong thing? And you know, it was an adventure game, and it was a fun adventure. It was very interesting.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, your very own RPG that you were playing at that time. Okay, so the format of the podcast is I've asked you to choose the five video games you'd like to put on your fictional ideal video games machine. Can you tell us about your first choice, which is from 1978? What was going on in your life when you first played this game, and what was it?
So the first game was Space Invaders. And I was living in Japan at the time. This is soon after I moved to Japan. I may have already had my first child at that time. She was born in 78. And there was a boom of Space Invader machines and copy Space Invaders machines. There were game centers where there would be like 30 tables, tabletop games, all Space Invaders. And there would be people in there playing Space Invaders at all these tables. It was just incredible. They were everywhere. So I started playing Space Invaders. If you play a game enough, you learn how to play you get the high scores and all that. So the system, you know, the Space Invaders move back and forth across the screen. And the method that I came up with is that you shoot a hole through the middle, get two columns of Space Invaders open. Yeah. So you have a clear shot to the UFO, which then comes out. And you have to count the shots. I think it's 13. So you have to waste a bunch of bullets. And then when the UFO comes across, I think it's the 13th or 14th bullet, then you hit it, you get 600 points. So that's how you max out. And then when the invaders go all the way to the bottom, like they're right at the bottom, you can run underneath and they can't hurt you. But by that time, they're moving really fast. So you got to shoot them as they're rushing across the screen at the end. And, you know, that's a level. You do that over and over and over again. I don't know. It feels like a beginning of a whole new form of entertainment.
Yeah, it really was. And the Space Invader itself, that little bunch of pixels, has really come to represent the whole medium, hasn't it? It appears everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I love that you're giving us some tips here on Space Invaders. That's great. So the 13 bullets that you tap out, do you mean that you tap the button as fast as you could and you always knew the 13th would definitely hit the UFO?
No. Basically,
you'd have to time it.
You just waste, like, you take 12 shots and then wait for the UFO to come, and then the 13th shot, that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
you have time.
And there's, you know, famously, Space Invaders was responsible, I don't know whether this is apocryphal or if it's true, but for a shortage of yen pieces in, was it 100 yen or 50 yen, it must have been, pieces in Japan at the time. Did you experience that? Was it really a craze? Did you have to queue up? You were actually playing Space Invaders in Tokyo at the time. What was that like?
Well, I was living in the country. I was living in a town called Kofu. So I wasn't really part of the Tokyo craze, per se. You know, I got good at it. So, yeah, 100 yen would last me like 30 minutes in a game. So an arcade game is balanced so that the average game length should be 3 minutes. And that's how they make their money. But, you know, if you get really good at it, you can just keep playing for a long time until you get fatigued.
Yeah, you're paying to put off the inevitable, aren't you, in an arcade game? Your failure's kind of built into it, but it's how long can you put that off for?
Yeah.
So you are Dutch, as you've said, but you studied in Hawaii. How did that work? And what took you out to Hawaii, and at what point in your life did that happen?
So 11 years in Holland, 8 years in New York City, junior high school and high school in New York City. And then my family, meaning my parents and my brothers at the time, decided to move to Japan. And Hawaii was a stopover on the way to Japan. That stopover, which was originally planned to be 2 weeks, turned into a year. By that time, I was going to university because in those days, the only way that you could get computer time is by going to school. There were no personal computers. This is before I started going to school so I could have computer time. First touch a computer in my high school in New York. And anyway, that's how I ended up at the university so I could have computer time.
And you were studying programming or computer science, were you?
Yeah, you could put it that way, but I didn't really go to university to study anything. I went to university so that I could have computer time. That was basically it. And to fill up the rest of my schedule, I took all kinds of courses that I was interested in, and only courses that I was interested in. In fact, when it came to 3 years, they called me and then they said, "Mr. Rogers, what are you doing?" And I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "Well, you haven't taken any of your core requirements." And I said, "Well, I've already been to high school. I don't actually need your core requirements."
Wow.
He says, "Well, if you're not going to take your core requirements, you won't be able to graduate." And I said, "There must be some mistake. I'm not here to graduate. I'm here to get an education."
Wow.
And I've already gotten it. Thank you very much. So after 3 years of going to University of Hawaii, I chased a girl to Japan, married her, and had a bunch of kids.
Wow, what a wonderful view of education. I think not one that the system perhaps supports that well, but yeah, I think probably the correct view, right?
Yeah.
And so this was a girl that you met at university, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you moved to, did you say it was Kofu in Japan?
Kofu, Yamanashi. Yamanashi is the half of Mount Fuji. The northern half is in Yamanashi prefecture. And Kofu is the capital of that prefecture.
Right, okay. And then, and so what did you, is that where she was from, or did you have a job to go to?
No, that's where my parents moved to, because my father was in the gem business, gemstones.
Right.
And Kofu used to get crystals, and so it became a gemstone capital of Japan. And so he was in that business. That's why we moved there.
So you were working for your dad in the gemstone business, were you, when you first got there?
Yeah, I worked for him for 6 years.
And then, you know, I talked in the introduction about the, you have this moment where you decide to go and buy a computer. And I think you spent quite a lot of money on it. Can you just tell me that story? What did you do and why did you do it?
Yeah, so I didn't actually buy the computer. This is that's not how the story goes. The story goes that I found a publisher in near where I lived, and I sold them on the idea of building a role playing game. They said they would give me the hardware and I could pay for it out of royalties. I didn't end up publishing through them. They changed the deal. I had a handshake deal with the president of the company, and they changed the deal. So I said, no, we have to stick to the deal, or it's no deal.
What did they try and change? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I said that I someday want to have my own publishing company. So the deal is that you get to subtract PR costs, marketing costs, advertising, all of those costs, and then whatever the profit is, we split the profit. But nope, they wanted to give me a percentage. I think it was 10%. We'll give you 10%, period.
Okay.
And so I wouldn't know anything about how to run the company, which is what I really wanted to learn. I didn't want just release a game. I wanted to find out how much people spent on what. So they changed the story, and I said, it's either the original deal or not. I was already halfway through building the damn thing at that point, and I had no money. I was basically bumming off my in-laws. I was living at my in-laws. At that point, I found a friend who came through I went to Akihabara and showed him the game, and we had a little crowd of kids there came around. They were all watching, and I didn't speak Japanese at the time, but he did. And they were going like, wow, this is great. So he wanted to invest in my company, and that's where the $50,000 came in. And as soon as we didn't have a deal on the on the computer with the publishing company, they sent me a bill for $10,000.
Oh, wow, cool.
So and I paid it. It's fine.
Yeah, okay.
And I just want to make sure that they didn't have any dibs on it after that. That sort of cleared our relationship completely.
Yeah, you were like paying them off, essentially. I see.
Yeah.
And just to go back to that scene. So you're in Akihabara and you're showing off this game to your friend. I mean, where were you doing that? Like in a cafe or in a shop?
No, in a computer shop. This is a personal computer.
Yeah.
And so it was Akihabara, in fact, where I went to see who is winning the personal computer business game in Japan.
Right.
And I found out at that time it was NEC was doing the best job. They had the best vision for, hardware. And so I just went to a shop that had NEC machines and plugged in my game. And we watched it. I didn't even notice the kids, but he was watching the kids.
And you decided to make it an RPG because you'd enjoyed Dungeons & Dragons while you were at university. But also, I mean, I suppose there weren't really RPGs or that many RPGs in Japan at that time. Was that part of your decision making?
Yeah. So what I kind of looked at is that personal computers in Japan were like 2 years behind what was going on in the States. So I was looking at which genres existed. And there was no RPG. There were no RPG games at all. And so I thought, oh, this is a big hole in the market. And, this is going to be a significant market segment in the future. So, and I can do this because I loved RPG from university. We had a group where we played games called ARG. And it's the Alternative Recreational Realities Group of Hawaii.
ARG.
ARG. That was the name of our group. And so, the Dungeons & Dragons rules came in little booklets and they were just not comprehensive. And so we made up we had to add all of our rules, and they're called ARG rules.
Amazing. So you took some of that into your design of this game that you were working
on. Oh, yeah, right. Absolutely. And I added some stuff of my own. Well, we could talk about Black Onyx all day, so let's not do that.
Well, I'm going to ask you a few more questions, but why don't we, before we do that, come to your second game? Because it comes from 1983, which was, I believe, the year when you came to release Black Onyx. So can you tell us, what's this game and why did it have an impact?
Are you talking about Mule?
I am, yeah.
Mule was one of Electronic Arts' first four games, and it was played on Atari 2600, and you connected four joysticks. It was four people playing on one screen. I mean, that was already revolutionary right there. But the game itself is classic. It's a classic, classic game. When years later, when even the machine was gone, at the Game Developers Conference, the GDC, which back then was actual game developers. There were no publishers. It was just us, you know? And we would set up rooms with machines. And one of the rooms definitely had Mule machines in it. And then maybe people playing Mule all night, you know, that kind of thing.
What can I say?
It's still a revolutionary concept, the way the whole game works.
Can you try and explain it in a nutshell?
Oh my goodness! You've got the mule is like, how can I say, the monster robot in Star Wars. It's like a lumbering thing that moves around. Each turn, you get to go out and claim a sector of land. You know, it can be for mining, it can be for energy, it can be for growing food, and so on. So you need to figure out where to get these plots of land. And then there is something called Christite, which is like the treasure, if you can find that. It's a land grab. And so all the mules go out and you have to grab a piece of land before somebody else does, or, you know, or grab something next door, that kind of stuff. If you don't have food, by the way, then your mule doesn't get to move the next turn. So you have to have food from somewhere. And then you can trade with the others. You can trade ore for energy, for food, and so on and so forth. I remember playing a game with Trip Hawkins, and he didn't have food, and I didn't sell him food. So I think it was a pretty frustrating game for him, but, you know, it's like, should I win this game or should I be friends with him? You know, like, that was a dilemma for me.
Yeah. So Trip Hawkins didn't publish any of your games then?
No, I published his games. That was the deal. So this was in Japan because I picked up two of the first four Electronic Arts games and published them in Japan.
Right, yeah, of course. And then he went on to do the 3DO, didn't he?
He went on to do 3DO. Yes, he did.
Yeah, Mule is such a influential game among game designers of that era. It's mentioned a lot, isn't it?
And
yeah, I've definitely been to talks about it at GDC before. So
yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Let's just head back to Tokyo then for a minute, because you know, I've always been fascinated in Black Onyx, and I think it's such an important game. in terms of the role it had in terms of popularizing RPGs in Japan. And unfortunately, that story is not as well known as it should be. Hopefully, this will contribute to it becoming better known. But can you just tell us how you convinced the Japanese market to become interested in this quite foreign style of game?
Right. Okay. So the very first interaction I had with it was my meeting with SoftBank. I was asking them to introduce me to another publisher because I couldn't work things out with the first one. They said, you know what, you should publish yourself. It's not that much. There's not that much to it. Just have your wife answer the phone when we make orders. And I said, okay, that sounds great. You know, of course, that's bullshit. There's a lot more to it than that. And they said that they would order 3,000 copies of Black Onyx for Christmas. And so that was my target. 3,000, that was pretty good. I worked my ass off to get this game ready in time for Christmas. Come close to Christmas, I had had some money for advertising. This is the cover. I had a friend in Hawaii that was from one of the art guys, and he was an artist. And he would draw people's characters. And I said, well, I sent him, there's a Frazetta, Frank Frazetta picture of Conan the Barbarian on top of
yes,
a pile of monsters. And I said, yeah, make me something like that. And he did.
Amazing.
So that was my ad.
What was your friend's name? We should credit him.
Wes Adachi.
Okay. That was the artist.
That was the artist.
Yeah,
Wes Adachi did the cover. And so I put a full page ad with that picture. For the entire month, we got like one phone call. So obviously people had no idea what this game or what that ad was about.
Right.
And I figured it out fast enough so that I put some screenshots into the next ad.
Yeah.
And then we got four calls in the second week.
Oh, wow. Five copies. Here we go.
And SoftBank said, we're really sorry, but we can, you know, we can't do 3,000 copies. We'll buy 600. I thought this was the end because I was going to run out of money.
Yeah, right.
By that time, I had a couple of employees and it's January. Gathered my employees and I said, how do people in Japan find out about computer games? And the answer was they read about them in the magazine. I said, well, how do you get into the magazine? It says, well, you have a hit game and then the magazines come to interview you. I said, well, that's obviously not happening because nobody knows what a role-playing game is, and nobody has an idea of what's going on with this game. So I said, okay, I'm going to switch things around. And I got my employees to make appointments with every magazine. And I went to visit them, and I showed them how to play the game. You know, what's your name? And I would type in their name. Which hairstyle is most like you? Pick that one. And, you know, I would make them characters for the game. And then I would take them on their first adventure. You know, so we'd walk around town. This is where the store is, where you can buy a knife or buy the... And we go downstairs, the first level, and have a little bit of adventure, kill a few monsters, get some experience, get some gold, and go back and buy some more stuff. And then I left them. Every single one of those magazines went nuts. They played the game day and night. It's 1 month to figure it out and 1 month to write the story. So in March, we had great stories coming out in every magazine about the game. And in April, we got an order for 10,000 copies of Black Onyx. April, May, 10,000, 10,000, 10,000. We had 10,000, 10,000 for the rest of the year.
Wow.
And that was a huge number in Japan. I was, oh my God, I actually got to buy a car.
What car did you get?
My first one was just a second-hand Toyota Corolla. But the one after that was a Soarer. These things never even left Japan. It was the first car that had a CRT display,
yes,
behind the steering wheel. And it was like, wow. It was like, you know, this is the future. And if you stop the car, you could actually watch television on this little thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was kind of revolutionary back then.
One last question on Black Onyx, and then we'll move on. I think it's widely regarded as the first game to graphically represent a health bar. So the health bars that are now very famous in Street Fighter and every game going, really. When did you have that idea? What made you think of doing it in such a way?
Well, the games before that, you know, Wizardry and Ultima, and I'd played a lot of Wizardry. All of these games had numbers for your status. You know, I kind of felt that that wasn't a visceral way of experiencing that. So I decided I wanted to have something on the screen that you could see at the corner of your eye without actually having to look over and see the damage. So basically, your character would start off with a certain number of hit points, and that was your bar. If you go up a level, you gain more hit points, and the bar becomes longer and longer and longer. If you're in a fight, every time you get damaged, that end of the bar starts to turn red. And the more red the bar is, you can see you're almost close to dying. And then if it turns all red, that's it, you're gone. I really wanted people to be able to see that out of the corner of their eyes. And the same thing, of course, for the monsters or your opponents. You see them, do I need to hit them three times or one time, or you know what I'm saying? You could gang up on one monster. Yes. All five of your characters could gang up on one monster. That's the technique. Or maybe one-on-one. There's different techniques for different monsters.
Yeah, wonderful. Revolutionary. What an inspired moment that was. Okay, why don't we come to your third game now, which is from 1987. What can you tell us about it?
Mini Maze. It was, again, an Atari machine. This is an Atari ST. Atari ST had two MIDI ports. It was a machine that was really great for people who were doing musical stuff. For years and years and years, Atari STs were in recording studios for sound effects and that kind of stuff. Well, it's had two ports. And so this game took which is now called an emoji, the have a nice day smiley face, and made that the central character in a first-person shooter. Okay, so the character in the first-person shooter, and so you have a joystick, and the joystick, you could go forward, you go backward, and if you move to the left, you turn to the left, it would rotate left and rotate right. So it's still the simplest first-person shooter interface. You know, all the ones that we have today, you have jump, you have strafe where you move side to side. It just basically takes ordinary people out of the ability to be able to navigate because it's too complicated. So this game was simple, and the target, again, a have a nice day smiley face, right at the point where you're going to shoot this, he's the fattest. It's the equator of the smiley face. And so when you actually push that button, the little ball would float towards your opponent. If you're far enough and you see it coming, you could actually dodge that bullet. So it's more like a snowball fight than
bullets,
because
yeah.
you can dodge a snowball. Again, tongue in cheek, fun. And you could connect the Atari STs with MIDI cables. So you could have as many of them as you want in a circle, and then each of you have a character inside this maze. And it's very simple. You have three hit points. If as soon as you get hit the third time, then you disappear from the game, and then after a couple of seconds, you reappear somewhere else in the game. So it's not a final thing. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to find somebody who's already been hit twice and be the third one to him, because then you get a point. And then his little smiley face appears on your screen, and you have like, I don't know, if you get 10 kills, then you win the game. It's a brilliant, simple game. I licensed it. I bought that game eventually and made a game called Faceball out of it for Game Boy. And it would have been a great game on Game Boy if they had just daisy-chained the Game Boys together.
Right.
But Nintendo came up with a little puck that you had to plug your Game Boy into, so four players could plug into this thing and then play one game. The problem with that, the puck interrupted your game all the time, saying, send me information. So it slowed the game down.
Yes, yeah.
To where it was unplayable. Yeah, in a daisy chain, you know, you get information and then you send information, so you're not interrupting the game. You're only doing it every once in a while.
Oh, how interesting. That's amazing. So, I mean, you mentioned there your relationship with Nintendo and making games for Game Boy. How did you come to meet Nintendo's president, Hiroshi Yamauchi, at that time?
My wife read an article in a magazine that said that Mr. Yamauchi plays Go. Wow, I play Go. My father plays Go. And somebody had submitted a game from England. I forget the name of the original game, but it was for the Commodore 64. It was a Go game, 9x9, tiny Go. It actually played Go. I mean, for a computer at that time to actually play Go was a miracle, let alone an 8-bit computer, let alone a 6502-based computer, because the Apple, Commodore, and the Nintendo machine all had the same CPU, the 6502, which meant that the algorithm for running the Go game I could just translate that algorithm bit for bit and not have to rewrite any code for that. So I sent Mr. Yamauchi a fact. My name is Hank Rogers. I can make a Go game for your Nintendo machine. I'm leaving for the States on Saturday. I would like to see you before I go. I didn't say I lived in Japan. That was Tuesday. And on Wednesday, I got a fax back from his assistant. Mr. Yamauchi will see you tomorrow.
Yikes.
It was like, whoa. that was so fast. And so I bullet trained it from Yokohama to Kyoto. I'm in my first meeting with Mr. Yamauchi. He goes, I can't give you any programmers. I said, I don't need programmers. I just need money. This is my first meeting in Japanese, by the way. Up till then, I'd had an interpreter.
Right.
And I came to the realization that my interpreter wasn't saying what I was saying.
Right, yeah.
And I would rather have broken Japanese where I'm actually saying it rather than my interpreter. So anyway.
I wonder what they would have translated you asking for money. They would have said something else.
I don't need programmers. I just need money. And he goes, how much? Yeah. And then, oh my God, I hadn't even thought about this at all at the moment. So I had to think of a number. And I thought the biggest number I could think of at the time, which was $300,000. So I said, $300,000. Yeah. And he reached across the table and shook my hand.
Wow.
It's that fast. I was like, holy shit, now what I have to do? What am I going to do? So, okay, thank you very much. And I hadn't even contacted the programmer in England. His name was Alan Scarf. Alan Scarf. I remember he lived in Reading. So I contacted...
So you had to call this guy up and say, we haven't met, but I've just sold your game to Nintendo.
Yeah, something like that. No, I said, look, here's the deal. You come to Japan and move your game to the Nintendo machine. I have programmers that can do the graphics and the sound. All I need you to do is make sure the algorithm gets across properly. He ended up living at my house for like 9 months.
No way.
We obviously made a deal, and it was a wonderful game. We had little ninjas jumping around, moving black and white ninjas moving the pieces around. I mean, we went to bat.
Yeah.
And so 9 months later, I'm back in front of Yamauchi, and he's going to play this. The problem was he had never used the game. How could it?
The Famicom controller.
Yeah, the controller. He was fumbling with the controller. I said, like, I couldn't believe it. This guy has never played his own game. I go, like, holy moly. Anyway, so he gives the controller to his underling sitting next to him, one of his employees. He points at the screen. I want to go there. I want to go there. I want to go there. I want to go there.
Like a king.
Yeah, like I want to go there. And so, and then he beats, and now he's a six-degree black belt in Go, as was my father. I'm about a third-degree black belt in Go. But anyway, he, after one game, says it's not strong enough for Nintendo.
Oh, man.
It's not strong enough for Nintendo. I said, Mr. Yamauchi, this is an 8-bit computer. It's a miracle that it can play Go at all, you know, that it can actually follow the rules of Go. And
when he said strong, does he mean it's not challenging enough, or what does he mean, something else?
The Go game was probably, I don't know, fifth degree black, a white belt. You know, it was just a beginner.
And it's okay. It means the AI is not up to scratch.
Yeah. There is no way to make it any stronger than that. Nobody's ever come up with a Go algorithm that runs in 64K, for Christ's sakes. Anyway, so I think fast on my feet. I said, well, then let me publish it. It's strong enough for my company. Then you can see ClipMy says, what about my money? You know, because he paid me $300,000. And I said, I will pay you $1 per unit until you have your money back. Deal. Shook my hand. And that's how I became a Nintendo publisher. Because at the time, they weren't letting personal computer developers become Nintendo publishers. They said, you know, the games that we're looking for are arcade games. So we've got all these arcade companies, Jaleco, Namco, all of these arcade companies that make games for us. We don't need you guys. Well, obviously that was wrong, because after that role-playing, you know, Final Fantasy Dragon Quest came out and they dominated the market.
Yeah.
So, I got to be a publisher.
You got to be a publisher. So now your games can go on Nintendo devices, and you've got a relationship with the big boss as well. And yeah. So do you remember the time, the day you first saw Tetris? Where were you?
Yeah, it was Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. Would be January something. My job was to bring games to Japan, because I was a publisher. I was looking for games. And so I just would go from machine to machine looking at games. And normally you just play give it one shot and see if you like it or not. Yeah. But Tetris, I found myself standing in line four times.
Wow.
You know, I would go somewhere looking at it, and I'd be back in line again. It's like, okay, I'm hooked on this game. That's when I figured out there's something there.
And you weren't the only one to become hooked on Tetris. I imagine there was a lot of competition at CES. Did you feel that you were really sort of having to hustle to try and get the conversations to find out if you could bring this game to Japan?
So I already knew the president of the company, Gilman Louie, from before. I've been looking for games, and he was a game publisher based in San Francisco. I specifically beat his high score. He had the high score on the machine, and I beat his high score on the machine. That was part of my drive. I did find, there was a couple of stories, okay? One was, I went, Broderbund, Doug Carlson German. Broderbund. Yeah, so I went to visit him. This is later, after I'd already released the product, and I asked him, so I was in his office, and I asked him about Tetris, and he said, oh yeah, I play it every day. He said, you play it every day? He says, yeah, why didn't you pick it up? He says, well, you know, my product manager decided not to pick it up.
Oh, man.
What? I was like, dude, you're playing a game every day, and you're listening to a product manager? Could I meet this guy? And then he called him in, and I shook his hand. Says the guy who turned down Tetris.
Oh, wow.
But it doesn't end there. It doesn't end there. Gilman Louie had his very first game was a game that he was paid to make by ASCII, which is the biggest company in Japan at the time, the biggest software company. They became ASCII Microsoft. They were big. His first port of call when he came to Japan after that CES was ASCII. ASCII looked at the game and passed on it because they said it was too retro.
Oh, it's not enough graphics.
I love it. Not enough action, not enough color, you know, blah blah blah. It's like, seriously, is that the reason that I play this game called Go, it's black and white stones, and it's the simplest looking game, but it's absolutely the deepest of all games.
It's had good longevity.
Go. Yeah, it is. So I'm not afraid that the black and white stones aren't little characters jumping around. No, that's fine. That a game is simple.
Yeah, it is. Okay, let's come to your fourth game here, which is from 1990. Can you tell us about it?
Spaceward Ho. I like space games in the first place. But this was a, I think it's just a brilliant little game. You you start off on, with your home planet. You send out scouts and you find out empty planets. If you find a planet that is, well, it's actually it's a star system, it must be, but find a planet that has similar gravity to your home planet, then you can send a colony ship there and they can colonize. Whatever temperature it starts off, it takes time to for you to terraform a planet. The closer it gets to your temperature of your home planet, which is 72 degrees Fahrenheit or 22 degrees Celsius, which is, by the way, the reason I set my air conditioning in my house at 72 degrees. So then the population would start to explode on that system. Yeah. And then you start getting more money. And you can spend money on technology, you can weapons, shields, drive, meaning how fast your ships go. You can spend money on radical technology, which is like rolling the dice that you're going to get some superpower. And eventually, you send a scout to some planet and there's already aliens there. Because during the game, there are aliens doing the same thing that you're doing. They start off on some home planet and they're growing. And so then that's when you start fighting over planets. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to stay ahead of the neighbors in terms of technology. Mm-hmm. If you build a fleet of, I don't know, fighter ships, you better use them right away, because if you wait, the other guy will have better technology and his dreadnoughts will wipe out your dreadnoughts. So you have to keep, you have to use them right away, basically. You can make alliances. And this is the one flaw in the game that I found. If you make an alliance and at the end of the game, all of the non-allied players, including the aliens, it says you lost, you lose. Because the victory condition is you're supposed to take over all of the universe, so to speak. What you have to do is you have to turn on your allies and wipe them out too, which I didn't like that about the game. Sometimes I thought, hey, you know, what if this game is happening for real? And here I am in control of some alien, call it the human race, and I'm not happy until I've wiped out all of the other aliens in the universe. I was examining my own motivations there. It's like, wow, is that what we're going to do? If we find alien planets, we're going to get all nervous and then we start a war and we're not going to be happy until we wipe them out. I don't know. We're not very friendly.
Oh, that's true.
It's interesting, I think, that a few of these games are about territory acquisition and sort of, having to be involved in negotiations as well with Mule. And, you know, there's definitely an element to this, to being an entrepreneur and trying to, publish other games as well. And I want to return to the story that we had right at the beginning where you turn up in the Soviet Union. The reason for that is, as we can sort of tell from your story from CES, is that lots of people were trying to buy Tetris to bring it out on their particular computers and hardware, and it ended up with dozens of people believing that they had the rights. You decide to go to Moscow to sort of clear this up once and for all. The game's been designed by Alexei Pajitnov, who was an employee, wasn't he, of the Soviet Computing Center, I think, or Computer Center. And so it's technically owned by the Soviet Union, but so you go and try and clear all of this up so it can come to the Nintendo Game Boy. What is it that you say to the people on the front desk when you turn up and try and have this meeting, to have this negotiation, because they don't know you're coming? How do you explain yourself?
Yes. First of all, I don't. I had my interpreter, I had hired an interpreter, and she helped me find Elorg. And then we're outside of the door of Elorg, and I'm about to go in. And she said, no, you can't go in there. I said, what do you mean I can't go in there? I said, you're here on a tourist visa. You're not allowed to go in there.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and I said, listen, I didn't come all this way, like 10 hours. I didn't come all this way to stand in front of a door to go back to Japan to get a piece of paper, like a different kind of visa and an invitation, just so that I could, no, that's not what I'm doing. I'm here. So I'm going through the door. Are you coming with me? And he goes, no, I can't go in there with you. And so I said, okay, you wait out here while I do my thing. And I went in through the door. So I'm inside the lobby of this place, and there's this, off to the side, there's a little window which is similar to the window at the airport with the the immigration whatever. This is a guy with one of those big round Russian hats, official like military hats, and his job is to register people as they come in. So I'm supposed to go over there and hand my papers, which I don't have any papers. So I just stood there in that lobby and waited for somebody to talk to me. And eventually somebody did. A woman came up to me and says, "How can we help you?" I said, "I'm from Japan. I'm the publisher of Tetris, and I would like to talk to someone about the handheld rights to Tetris." She went away, and then a little while later, this man comes down the stairs, and that's Mr. Belikov. And I said, you know, I showed him the game, and I had it in my hand and showed it to him. And I said, "I'm the publisher of Tetris, you know, on console in Japan." And then he looked at the box and he said, "We never licensed the console rights to anyone."
Oh, man.
And I said, "You never licensed the console rights to anyone. I had licensed it from Atari Games, who had licensed it from Mirrorsoft, who had licensed it from Andromeda, who had licensed it from Alorg." And I said, "Here, look at that copyright notice. It's, you know, this is all the people in, you know, that, you know, and you're credited as a copyright." So I, you know, and he says, "No, we never licensed to anyone." And he's like, "Oh." And at that very moment, I had 100,000 cartridges in manufacture, 200,000 cartridges. And what I had borrowed money from the bank using my in-laws' property as collateral. Wow. All of it. So, OMG, you know, I'm in such deep kimchi at that moment. You know, and trying to figure it out. And I decided not to try to deal with that and focus on the handheld rights. So I spent the next week. And by the way, he said, I would like to come back tomorrow and meet with someone to talk about the handheld rights. And the reason I said that is because I had no idea whether the right people would be in the room today.
Clever.
And so he said, "Yes, come back tomorrow." That "come back tomorrow"
yes.
meant I had an invitation.
You could take an interpreter.
Yeah, come back tomorrow. And so the next day I was in a room and I don't know, there were eight people across the table, including Alexei Pajitnov, and I was being interrogated. You know, like how did I think I had the rights and how does the publishing... You know, and I just explained everything. I was complete open book. And I was a game designer. So the fact that I was a game designer, Alexei... Immediately, when he realized I was a game designer, I wasn't just some,
yeah,
you know,
businessman,
guy trying to get rights. I was the first game designer that he met that was from outside the Soviet Union. So that was fascinating. We became friends immediately on the game design side. And I won everybody over because I was just being honest, you know.
Was there any part of you that was worried that you were going to end up in prison?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In the beginning, it was like, who knows what's going to happen? You know, these guys don't like me. I'm the pirate guy and they've got me here. So they could keep me hostage until I paid them or whatever. You know, there's all these different things that were going through my mind. But anyway, I made it through. You have to watch the movie to find out what actually happened.
Very good. Just one other aside on this. So I believe that, you know, just in an amazing filmic twist, you happen to turn up in Moscow on the same day as the soon-to-be-disgraced media mogul Robert Maxwell's son, who had also turned up to try and purchase the rights to Tetris. Did you see him at all when you were there?
No. I had no idea he was there. And Belikov was having meetings with me in the morning and him in the afternoon, that kind of thing. We were having all these meetings. And Mr. Belikov asked me, "Mr. Rogers, why should we choose you over Kevin Maxwell?" Ah, it's like, that's when I found out Kevin Maxwell was there.
Damn it.
And I said, "Mr. Belikov, I'm not a rich man like Robert Maxwell and his son, Kevin Maxwell. So I cannot pay you as much money up front as they can. But I will give you a fair share of the money." You know, because up till then, the deal had been percentage-based, and he was getting a percentage of a percentage of a percentage, which meant that he had nothing.
Mm, yeah.
And I said, "I will pay you X amount." I think it's like 25 cents.
Right.
I will give you 25 cents for every copy of Tetris sold on Game Boy. 25 cents. Guaranteed. No matter how many people are in between, everyone that you that sells, you'll get 25 cents. And at the end, you know, they chose honesty and a real piece of the action over political pressure, because the Politburo actually came down on him, on Belikov. There was a period of time when people in Elorg, no one would talk to him because he was definitely going to a gulag or something.
Because they thought he'd sold it to the wrong person.
Because he had made a decision which is different from the decision that came from up high. Maxwell, Robert Maxwell, tried to turn tried to flip the decision and say, give it to me instead. And he actually was supposed to meet with Gorbachev when Gorbachev was coming to England to tell Gorbachev to flip this deal, to cancel my deal. And what happened is Gorbachev was in England when the earthquake in Armenia hit. So he ended up having to cut his visit short, and he had to go to Armenia. So Maxwell never got to meet Gorbachev on that trip.
Amazing. Well, I think I don't think it's libelous to say that they made the right decision.
That's right. I think so.
Towards Robert Maxwell.
I think so.
He probably would have gone to prison for pension fraud, wouldn't he, before, if he hadn't have fallen off his yacht.
Yes.
The Ghislaine and disappeared. Okay, well, I mean, I could talk to you forever about this, but we should probably come to your fifth game for your fictional games console. This is from 2007. It's a video game based on a board game, I believe. Can you tell us about it?
Oh, right. So there's a German game called Settlers of Catan. They came up with a computer version of it. Actually, some university came up with a computer version on it, of it. And Settlers of Catan is a very, I would say it's one of the best board games ever.
Yes.
Yeah, you could say it has something to do with Mule, in that you're trying to capture all these plots of land that then produce resources. Wheat and ore and clay and, you know, whatever. You put a town down, you put it on the intersection of three hexagons. Yeah. And the three hexagons are different kinds of resource-producing regions. You collect the resources from these places, and then you build more roads, you build more towns, you upgrade your town to a city, which means that you double production, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There is negotiation in this game, because when you're short of something, you can trade with another player. So I can trade you wheat for ore, two wheats for one ore, whatever. You make all these deals. The computer version, it just created a community. The way it worked is, if you won a game, you would move halfway in the rank between you and the best player in that game. So your rank would go up. And for some reason, a lot of the players, the top players, were in Holland. I never quite figured out why that was, but it was. And I'm originally from the Netherlands, so I could bond with them. So we formed a team among the people that were in Hawaii, some of my family members and friends. I got them all involved in the online game. Uh-huh. And to take over the top spots, we would have to wake up early in the morning when the Dutch players were playing, because they were on the other side of the world. If we got to all the top spots, we could just play at night, and they would have to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning to play. So we created a team, Settlers of Hawaii. And we each had our game name, but we all followed it by SOH, Settlers of Hawaii. Yeah, I mean, it's just such a great community game. And I did go to Holland afterwards, and these people all got together, and we played real Settlers on boards. You know, we gathered in some place in Holland.
Oh, lovely.
Which is nice.
Yeah, so nice. Yeah, so many of your games about territory and negotiation, Hank. It's a theme.
Yeah, it is. I guess it is a theme, you know. But it's good. It's people need to work together or you can compete. You still have to interact, you know? There's so many games that people play that just don't involve that much personal interaction.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, so Heng, we've got your console here with the five games: Space Invaders, Mule, M-U-L-E, MIDI Maze, Spacewood Ho, and Settlers of Catan. Very fine console. We need a name to give your console that we can market to the world. I imagine you've come up with quite a few names in your time. What would you like to call this games machine that we're going to take out? I guess to the Japanese market first.
Oh, to the Japanese market. Wow.
Well, we can take it anywhere.
Put me on the spot. The intelligent game machine.
Very nice. A reference to the Intellivision there almost. We're coming full circle. Very nice.
Maybe, but intelligent game machine. I like to think that we should be using our minds when we play games more than, you know, using our fingers.
Yes, indeed, yeah. Yeah, the best games are a combination of the two, aren't they?
I think.
So, I mean, I could definitely talk to you for another hour, Henk, but I guess we must bring this to an end, but thank you so much for chatting. I've just got a couple of very quick questions before I let you go. I mean, we've heard the story up until the moment where you secure the rights for the Game Boy version of Tetris that goes on to be bundled with the Game Boy all around the world and sells millions of copies. I imagine that's changed your life pretty much immediately. Obviously, you'd had successes before that, but nothing on this scale. You know, how well did you cope with that sudden change in circumstances?
I bought a house.
Yeah.
I bought a house in Hawaii on the beach.
Yes.
It's like four doors down from where Obama spends his Christmases.
Oh.
You know, on the beach in Kailua. So, and I bought a Hobie Cat and I went sailing. When I was in Hawaii, I would go sailing every day.
Okay.
So, yeah. It.
So you've lived there ever since?
No. I lived in Hawaii. It became ridiculous because my tax consultant said I couldn't live here for more than 180 days. So that meant that I had to be away from my family for 180 days a year, and that was killing me.
Right.
And so at the end, we decided just to move back to Japan and rent out the house in Kailua. But by that time, my kids spoke English, and they could go to international school. So that was part of the reason why I wanted them to move. I wanted to move them to Hawaii
to
learn English.
So you had to leave the Obamas behind.
Well, this is way before the Obamas.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah.
You know, we're talking about early 90s. I mean, so you must have been, you didn't have any. But he went to school here in Hawaii.
I've seen a picture of you with him before, so you have met him, haven't you?
Yeah. I have. He went to school here, and now my granddaughter's going to school. Punahou.
I mean, you've obviously had a very vibrant, successful life, as we can hear from this chat we've had today. But, you know, it also strikes me that you've taken some major risks to have that life at some key moments. And, you know, obviously the world's very different now to how it was in the 80s and early 90s. But what advice might you give to a young Henk Rogers striking out today, trying to find some games to publish? What sort of things might you advise him to look for and how to do business?
Yeah, follow your instinct. You know, if you ask people, say you're going to take a risk, you ask people, they all tell you, no, that's don't do that. That's too dangerous. And if you listen to that, then you're basically going to be like them. if you want to be an entrepreneur, you're going to have to strike out and do something that's different from everybody else. On some level, you have to be a little bit hard-headed and not listen to everybody, because everybody doesn't have the same, how can I say, chutzpah that you do. Follow your passion, and when you get the opportunity, go for it. I always compare it to surfing. Don't be afraid to make a mistake. Before you learn how to surf, you're going to fall off your board a bunch of times, and you can't just read a book and learn how to surf. You've got to get in the water. Fall off your board a bunch of times, no problem. Once you learn how to surf, then when the business condition is right, when a big set finally comes in, then you'll actually be able to do that. You can't do it if you haven't surfed the little waves before. Find the timing. The timing has to be right for you to do your business. I can tell you this. I've started a lot of business that were like 5-10 years too soon. And, you know, I have spent, I don't know, a lot of money on a company called Avatar Reality. You know, now it would be a great company to have. But, but not when I built it and spent all the money. We were ahead of our time.
Yeah, time's going to be right. Henk, thank you for sharing your wisdom and your story. I've absolutely loved this, and it's been great to finally talk in person, almost, at least. So thank you again.
All right, take care.
Yeah, you take care too. A huge thank you to my guest, Henk Rogers, for his time, for coming on My Perfect Console, and for telling us his story in this, the week of the release of the dramatization of some of the story that we heard him talking about there, the Tetris story. Tetris is out on the 31st of March, in 3 or 4 days after this comes out. You can see it on Apple TV. Of course, Tetris was not designed by Henk. It was designed by his very good friend, Alexei Pajitnov. But the film of Tetris chooses for its protagonist Henk's story. So you will be able to see the dramatization of what he's been telling us about there. Wonderful story. Probably one of the most exciting stories around a classic video game and how it came to become so popular. I was also really thrilled to be able to talk to Henk about how he brought the role-playing game to Japan. There's been a lot of discussion about so-called Japanese role-playing games during the last few weeks, after one of the developers of the new Final Fantasy game said that he felt it was a derogatory term, JRPG or Japanese RPG. And I saw all sorts of people on social media holding forth on the history of how the role-playing game first came to Japan. And almost all of them, I think, missed the fact that Black Onyx was instrumental in popularizing that form. Henk, obviously, going around to the offices of the editors of the largest games magazines at the time, who had, in many cases, never played a role-playing game, asking them to put their name in, to name their character, to make their character look like themselves, and then those orders start flooding in. It's only a few short years later that we start to see the really classic games in that form, Dragon Quest and Final Fantasy. Great to hear that story, and I hope it becomes a bit more embedded in the cultural consciousness about video games, because it's a really, really important part of video game history. Okay, you can write to me at myperfectconsole@gmail.com. Thank you to those who have been doing that. It's always lovely to hear your suggestions for guests, and you've had some very, very good ones who I'm absolutely going to be approaching. Got like a really good lineup of episodes already in the can, so I might slow down a little bit with booking people on till some of these episodes have come out. But yes, it's exciting times, and exciting to see how the podcast has been growing and, you know, the popularity it's attracting, as people appear to be enjoying this lens through which we can talk to some familiar figures. You can follow me at Simon Parkin on Twitter. And you can follow the podcast as well at My Perfect Console with the O's removed. Each week you will get a little recap of what the week's guest has picked for their perfect console, as well as a trailer for the following week's guest, which comes out on Friday. You can get a little sneak peek of who it's going to be coming up, if that's of interest. Also, if you head along to Acast Plus, you can become an early access supporter. For just £3 a month, you will get your episodes 24 hours before the general public and ad-free. And it's also just a great way to help make the podcast sustainable in the long term. I do run ads, obviously, but, you know, that's not quite enough to keep the microphone on, as it were. So, that helps if you're willing and able and in a position to do so. Okay, remains for me to say thank you again for listening. Thank you to my guest, Henk Rogers, and I'll be back again next week with a new guest, their 5 games, and one more perfect console.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.